We'll see more clouds in the Granite State today and some showers, especially this afternoon. Highs from 55 to 60 today. Tonight, still mostly cloudy and a few showers will pop up. Overnight lows between 45 in Coos County and 50 to the south and at the coast. Wednesday, we'll see a few more breaks of sun, but still a mostly cloudy day overall with a chance of a pop-up shower once again. Highs in the mid to upper 60s. The pattern starts to break down Thursday. We'll finally see some sunshine and warmer temperatures by Friday. In Nashua now, it's 50, 54 in Keene, 51 in Hanover, 52 in both Gorham and Portsmouth. It's also 52 in Concord. This is NHPR News at 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. He's gone after cigarettes, trans fats, and now New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg is leading a crusade against soda. Last week, the mayor proposed a ban on the sale of soda and other sugary drinks larger than 16 ounces in the city's delis, fast food joints, and sports arenas. Bloomberg says soda is a prime culprit when it comes to New Yorkers expanding waistlines, and that instead of wringing its hands over the obesity epidemic, his administration is doing something about it. The mayor's quest against sweet drinks is part of a growing wave of anti-sugar sentiment. Although long criticized for tooth decay and so-called empty calories, new research links the sweet stuff to some serious health problems. Not just obesity, but also diabetes, cancer, and even memory loss. In fact, some scientists have called sugar toxic and say it should be a regulated substance like tobacco. But while no one advocates for open-ended sugar consumption, other researchers do feel all this recent sourness about sugar has gone too far. We've been down this road before, they warn, with recent crazes against fats or carbs, neither of which improved Americans' overall health. A better approach, they say, is following that old advice, everything in moderation. Today in The Exchange, shunning sugar. We'll look at the latest research and the debate over how to reduce our consumption of it. And let's hear from you, too. Do you see sugar as linked to all these ills? Obesity, cancer, diabetes? Are some efforts to curb sugar consumption going overboard? Is the old adage, everything in moderation, still the best advice? Or does that advice no longer fit, given what we now know about sugar? Give us a call, the exchange number, 1-800-892-NHPR, 1-800-892-6477. You can email us at exchange@nhpr.org. We have two guests who've been looking at this for a long time. Joining us from Connecticut is Dr. David Katz, founding director of Yale University's Prevention Research Center. He's editor-in-chief of the journal Childhood Obesity, also president-elect of the American College of Lifestyle Medicine. And Dr. Katz, great to have you. Thanks for your time.
My pleasure, Laura. Thank you.
Also joining us from California, Gary Taubes. His most recent book is Why We Get Fat and What to Do About It. He's a contributing correspondent to the journal Science and a Robert Wood Johnson Foundation independent investigator in health policy at the University of California at Berkeley. And Gary Taubes, thank you also very much for getting up early there out in the West Coast and joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, and Gary, I'll turn to you first. You know, you write that you spent the last decade looking at this issue of diet and disease, and you've come to the conclusion that sugar is pretty bad stuff. In fact, you wrote recently that sugar scares me. How come?
Well, there's a lot of evidence out there, and there has been. This is not a new debate, but there's been evidence out there for, you know, since the Industrial Revolution that sugar could be the sort of ultimate cause of this whole series of chronic diseases, obesity, diabetes, gout. And by that, I mean, if we simply didn't have sugar in our population and our food supply, those diseases, for the most part, would not exist. And it's a radical claim, and yet it's getting more and more credibility from the recent research. So that's what I mean by it scares me. We can talk about eating it in moderation, but then you have to ask the question, what does moderation mean if, for instance, without any sugar, a disease like cancer would be a rare disease?
Wow. So all the stuff we heard about fat, not true? I mean, I could eat potato chips, and as long as I had no sugar, I'd be okay?
Well, I get a lot of credit for, debunking the fat hypothesis. Michael Pollan referred to me as the Alexander Solzhenitsyn of the field, for good or bad. But the idea that we probably got it wrong about dietary fat does not imply logically that we are thus getting it wrong about sugar.
What do you think, Dr. Katz? Are you afraid of sugar?
Well, if by fear, Laura, you're asking, do I think it's causing harm? Absolutely, yes. There's a huge excess of sugar added to our diets, and there's no question whatsoever that it's contributing, importantly, to an excessive intake of calories. And, of course, it's an excess of calories, ultimately, that fuels the obesity epidemic and all the downstream diseases that ensue from that, diabetes, increased heart disease, cancer, stroke. All the slings and arrows of modern outrageous fortune, really, are driven by energy imbalance and the obesity epidemic. And sugar's a big part of that, no question. So in that sense, yes, it scares me, but, and this is why you have me on, so that Gary and I don't just spend an hour agreeing with one another, it also scares me to put, if you will, all of our eggs in any one nutritional basket. And it's really not that my message is everything in moderation. My message is we have to think holistically. We have to think holistically about human health. You know, as a physician, I'm not doing you a favor if I say you're fine because you don't have a bullet hole through you, but by the way, you have some other terrible thing wrong with you. Health is either intact or it's not. And frankly, the healthiness of food, the healthfulness of food, is much the same. So we have gone down this road before where we have become preoccupied as a culture with just one nutrient at a time. And if you're familiar with Richard Dawkins, he's an evolutionary biologist, and when he talks about species adapting to an environment, he notes that there are many more ways to be dead than alive. In other words, you really have to adapt well to live, and any other way you adapt will bring your species to its end. Well, to borrow from him, there are many more ways to eat badly than well, and we have discovered quite a few, and I think if we become fixated on just sugar, we will invent a new one.
Yeah, so we're not looking at the whole picture here. You know, you mentioned evolution, Dr. Katz. Is there a evolutionary reason why most of us like sugar so much?
Absolutely. We actually have been consuming sugar since before Homo sapiens were sapient once, let alone twice, because even our pre-hominid ancestors ate fruit. It's possible some of them ate honey as well. So those were natural sources of sugar, including specifically fructose, if we're going to get into that. But probably the single greatest advantage of having an adaptation that makes us like sugar is the fact that breast milk is sweet. Milk contains sugar. It contains lactose. And, of course, that's different from table sugar, and it's different from fructose. But it is a sugar. It's a source of glucose. And studies have shown that given a choice between water or the sweet beverage milk, neonates just born, and this is true of human babies but also other mammal species, will prefer the milk. And you could well imagine that, you know, if you're born with different taste buds that didn't like that and you didn't drink the milk, well, you wouldn't stick around very long and your genes wouldn't get passed on. So, yes, we're certainly adapted to like sweet. We're adapted to like sugar, and it is an important nutrient in the first fuel that all mammals share, namely the breast milk of their mothers.
Well, and I want to just ask one more important clarifying question before we dive into this, you know, everything in moderation, yes or no, what does moderation mean, and so forth. But just to get a definition out of the way, Gary Taubes, okay, so what are we talking about when we say sugar? I mean, clearly the white granular stuff and the brown granular stuff, but what about honey? What about maple syrup? What about agave? What about, other sweeteners?
Yeah.
Go ahead, Gary.
This is one of the crucial questions. And in response to what David just said, there's actually, you know, it sounds very reasonable, and this is what we've believed for decades. And the point that I've been making and others like me is that, you know, beginning with how we get fat, you know, the title of my book is Why We Get Fat, and the argument is not actually that we get fat because we take in more calories than we expend, but that obesity is a hormonal defect, just like any other growth disorder. You know, if you see someone walking down the street who's 8 feet tall, you don't worry about how many calories he took in or expended. If you're a doctor, you ask yourself whether you should get him into an MRI machine so you can pinpoint the tumor he must have in his pituitary gland that's making him over-secrete growth hormone. So the idea is that obesity just is just a hormonal defect, and that defect is triggered by the carbohydrate content of the diet, and particularly the sugars.
So the obesity epidemic, I'm sorry to interrupt you, I just want to make sure I get it crystal clear. So obesity is caused by this hormonal reaction from overconsumption of sweet stuff? Is that what you're saying, Gary?
Well, again, even the term overconsumption, remember we're asking if it scares you, you ask the question,
yeah.
Does that mean is there a safe level at which I can consume it?
Right.
Like we decided that there is no safe level at which you can consume cigarettes because even at, you know, if you're smoking, if you're getting secondhand smoke, you're likely to get adverse health effects. So the question with sugar would be a similar one. Is there a level beneath which it harms no one, if it indeed harms anyone, other than through its excess calories? So the argument for physicians have always argued the worst we could say about sugar is that it's empty calories. The
right.
Sugar industry loves this argument because then they are no worse than any other nutrient. The argument that we've been making and that the evidence seems to support is that sugar is creates a unique hormonal environment in your body because of the way it's metabolized. And this environment then, in turn, causes these diseases.
So sugar creates a unique hormonal environment, which in turn causes obesity. Is that what you're saying, Gary?
Well, obesity, diabetes, heart disease, they're all caused by, on some level, they are caused by a condition known as insulin resistance, where we secrete insulin in response to the carbohydrates we consume, in part to control our blood sugar. This is why diabetics have problems with insulin secretion.
So does that mean we shouldn't eat fruit because fruit has a natural sweetness in it?
Well, and here's the other issue, is it's not so much merely the presence of these foods. If you buy this hypothesis, which I've been examining in my writing,
mm-hmm.
It's the speed with which we digest them and the speed with which these nutrients hit our bloodstream. So you can imagine, for instance, I could apply, say, 50 pounds of force to your, you know, shoulder by leaning on you for 20 minutes, and it's going to be annoying, but it's not going to cause chronic damage. If I apply that 50 pounds of force in a second by punching you, we've got a real problem. And so what the argument is, when you digest these foods quickly, and what we've done in the past 400 years and mostly since the Industrial Revolution is created sugar and refined sugar to the point that we could digest it quick. We can digest huge doses very quickly, and then you throw them into liquids, the sugar-sweetened beverages, and now you have this sort of perfect vehicle for getting these things to your liver and into your bloodstream as fast as humanly possible, and that our bodies haven't evolved to deal with that.
And that's why
and
some
that's
say drinks are
effects come from.
Yeah. That's why some say drinks are worse than eating a cookie because it enters your body so quickly. Lots more questions for both of you gentlemen after a short break, and you can join us at 1-800-892-6477.
Good morning, it's 9:19, and more on getting sour on sugar on the exchange on NHPR at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show. New concerns about the global economy. New Hampshire weather today, cloudy with some showers, high temperatures 55 to 60 degrees. Tonight, mostly cloudy, a chance of a few showers, lows from 45 to 50. Then tomorrow, mostly cloudy, some occasional sunshine, still a chance of showers, highs from 65 to 70 degrees. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Gripponi Auto Group, featuring multiple lines of fuel-efficient, environmentally friendly cars at Gripponi Auto Junction in Bow and online 24 hours a day at gripponi.com. And from New Hampshire Magazine and its 11th annual Best in New Hampshire party, featuring food from more than 60 restaurants, plus music and entertainment. Details at bestofnh.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, examining the facts and fables about too much sugar in our diets. Let's get your thoughts. Call in 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or send a short email to exchange@nhpr.org. Also, The Exchange is now on Facebook, so we hope you go to our page, join the conversation there. Tell us what you think about this conversation we're having. New research indicating sugar is linked to many modern ills, not just obesity and diabetes, but also cancer. Some recent research looked at possibly a link between sugar and memory loss. Do you see sugar as linked to all these ills? Do you see some modern efforts to curb sugar going overboard? What about that old advice, everything in moderation? Is that still the best advice, or does it no longer make sense given what we now know about sugar? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange at nhpr.org. And Dr. David Katz, before the break, we were talking with Gary Taubes about, you know, what about all these different sweeteners? You know, is a tablespoon of white sugar better or worse than a tablespoon of honey? What about the natural sugar in fruit? What about artificial sweeteners like aspartame or saccharin? Are these all created equal or not?
They're clearly not all created equal, Laura, but I think if we want to level the playing field, we would take advantage of the famous quote by Paracelsus, who is considered the father of modern toxicology: the dose makes the poison. So, sure, you could get an excess of sugar and calories from honey or maple syrup or agave, and frankly, they're much more alike than different. Sugar is sugar. One of the important issues for this debate, and much of this was set in motion by the writings of Dr. Robert Lustig. He's a pediatric endocrinologist whose YouTube video went viral on the topic of sugar as a poison and has been opining on it since. And you know, he seems to be making the case that fructose is a unique poison. So sugar is bad, but it's really fructose that's uniquely bad. And, of course, fructose is famous as being part of high fructose corn syrup. What people may not realize is that table sugar, sucrose, kind of sugar we've been eating for a very long time, is 50% glucose, 50% fructose.
Mm-hmm.
And high fructose corn syrup is 45% glucose and 55% fructose at most. They're very much alike. So let's start by acknowledging that sugar is sugar, and adding sugar to the diet is bad when you do it in excess. It doesn't really matter what kind. Artificial sweeteners, calorie-free sweeteners, are clearly different, but I think there's a real peril there. And if I could back up for just a second, Laura, before the break, Gary used a very lovely analogy about applying force, and if you push against someone slowly, it doesn't hurt, but if you hit them quickly with the same force, it will startle and potentially hurt them. And we have to worry about how quickly substances raise blood sugar. But we have a good measure of that, I suspect most listeners have heard of, the glycemic index. Essentially, that's a measure of how fast and how high consuming a food raises blood sugar, which then in turn tends to precipitate a release of insulin. And both of those are bad. A spike and a dip in blood sugar is bad, and a surge in blood insulin is bad. And in fact, that's the kind of hormonal imbalance that Gary was referring to. Well, we actually have, from really good data, evidence that starchy foods can at times have a higher glycemic response. So
like
higher,
white bread, faster,
than pure sugar.
Well,
actually, white bread has a higher glycemic index than table sugar. So here's one of my worries if we fixate on just sugar. And again, I agree, we eat way too much sugar, we need to fix that. I want to do it holistically, and I think the single message is dangerous. I imagine the food industry salivating right now over the opportunity to create a whole new league of artificially sweetened starchy foods that will wear the banner ad on the front of the package, approved by Dr. Lustig and Gary Taubes, you know, and free of added fructose. People will feel virtuous.
You can promise that there will never, I can promise you there will never be a banner saying a processed food has been approved by Gary Taubes.
Okay, two quick things, gentlemen, that I'm still not clear on. And one is, Dr. Katz, for you, again, I'm not clear on fruit, okay? I mean,
clearly a good thing. I will state that emphatically. So, you know, I've actually corresponded with Dr. Lustig extensively about this. I think Gary said it very clearly. But it does, I think the fact that you're asking the question, Laura, highlights the danger of the sugar is poison platform, because fruit contains sugar. And fruit specifically contains fructose, which is the especially vilified sugar we've been hearing about lately. And there is the danger of tossing out the baby with the bathwater. And if we'd like to think we're immune to that, all we need to do is look at the follies of history, because at the height of the low-carb craze, people were avoiding fruit. They were avoiding carrots because they have a high glycemic index. You know, my response to that is, you show me the person who can blame obesity or diabetes on eating carrots, and I will give up my day job and become a hula dancer.
Okay.
Gentlemen, I'd like to invite our listeners into our conversation.
Gentlemen, I'd love to invite our listeners into our conversation. We have so much to talk about. I've got a stack of emails. So let's go to them, and I'm sure all these issues will shake out from those calls and emails. And I want to remind you that you can join us at 1-800-892-6477. Join our conversation. Lots of headlines about sugar and the ill stemming from it lately. Give us your thoughts, questions, and comments at 1-800-892-6477. And Annie's waiting in Campton. Hi, Annie. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you. I learned in a biochemistry class in college that glucose is the major food source for the brain. So I'm wondering how that fits in all this negative crusade against sugar.
Glucose is a major food source for the brain. Is that what you said, Annie?
Yes.
Okay.
That's what she said, yeah.
All right. Go ahead. Gary Taubes, you want to tackle that one?
Sure. Glucose is a major fuel source for the brain, particularly when you're eating a carb-rich diet, as we do in the U.S. today. If you don't actually get glucose from the diet, your body will produce it from the protein, converting the amino acids from the protein you consume and from the something called glycerol that's released when you burn fat. There's a lot of confusion about that abounds. But when we're talking about sugar, and this is where Dr. Lustig gets invoked in this idea that fructose is a problem. As David pointed out, Dr. Katz pointed out, sugar and high fructose corn syrup are both roughly half glucose and half fructose. And the point of this is that fructose is metabolized in the body entirely differently than glucose. It's metabolized mostly in the liver, where glucose goes into your bloodstream and is metabolized by virtually every cell in your body. So the effect of interest here is that whether or not this fructose hitting the liver and the doses that we hit it these days actually caused this condition called insulin resistance. So one of the differences between what Dr. Katz and I are saying, and it's interesting because he's a clinician and I'm the journalist, but even when we get to fruit, we tend to have a one-size-fits-all prescription in the U.S. And again, the argument that I'm being made is that some people, the same amount of sugar, the same amount of fructose, will have a different effect on one person than another. So if you find someone who's obese and someone who's lean, it doesn't necessarily mean that the obese person ate more sugar. They might have ate even the same amount of sugar or even less, and the lean person could be someone who merely tolerates sugar much better, and that's why they can eat it.
Whose body
and
processes
one of the questions we have to answer is, are some people particularly intolerant to the sugar in the diet? And once they get quite obese, quite type 2 diabetics, once insulin resistance has seriously set in, maybe even the sugar in fruit is too much for their bodies to tolerate and will keep them fat or keep them type 2 diabetics.
Well, Annie, thanks for that call. And here's an email from Robert in Epsom. And Dr. Katz, this is for you because it references something you talked about earlier. Robert asks, what are the pros and cons of artificial sweeteners like aspartame? You said that there's a peril with those sweeteners earlier.
Right.
Go ahead.
Right. Okay, I was going to quickly add to the response to Annie that she's absolutely right, that glucose is the fuel of the brain and the body makes it when it doesn't get it, and it's hard to say that something the body produces is a poison. Now, an excess is bad. But to the question about artificial sweeteners, there are currently four of them that prevail in the marketplace, Robert, and there will be more. Stevia is going to become a more significant factor in the food supply. The ones we currently have are between 600 and 1,300 times as sweet as sugar. And we talk about a sweet tooth in the vernacular. We don't talk about a sugar tooth, and I think we're exactly right. Our preference, you know, what taste buds react to is a taste, the sensory phenomenon of a taste. And they give us a reward when we eat sweet. And the more sweet you eat, the more sweet you want. And that's really what a sweet tooth is all about. And frankly, if you feed it, you grow it into a sweet fang, and it can take over your life.
Wow, so it's addictive.
Yeah, well, I think arguably yes, and I've made that argument before. For all intents and purposes, sugar might as well be considered addictive. But it's not just sugar, it's sweet, really. The more you get, the more you want. And so if we get artificially sweetened foods, they will trigger that same reward and make us want to eat more and more and more. And then it becomes a question of where are you getting these? And if we focus on just sugar and the public thinks, well, as long as I avoid added sugar, I'm fine, and they do eat artificially sweetened starchy foods, which apparently will not wear the Gary Taub seal of approval, I think they may feel virtuous, may think, well, at least it's sugar-free. I can eat four times as much, and guess what? Just like we did when we ate oat bran, and just like we did when we just cut fat, and just like we did when we just cut carbs, we'll get fatter and sicker until or unless we see the forest through the trees, until or unless we look at the whole quality of a food. And so, frankly, in my world, I'm really not saying, you know, everything in moderation. I haven't had a soda in 35 years. I think it's a chemistry experiment in a cup, and I don't think anybody should drink any of it, artificially sweetened or sugar sweetened. What I think we ought to do is look at overall nutritional quality. I think we should avoid artificial sweeteners, and I think we should avoid foods with excessive additions of sugar. But I think vilifying a single nutrient leads to trouble like a lateral move from excess sugar to artificially sweetened starchy foods, which the body will convert to sugar very readily, and it will do all the same kinds of harm.
Well, and let's take another call. This is Jarrett in Danbury. Hi, Jarrett. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. It's great to be on. I listen to you guys all the time. Anyway, Gary is probably going to know what I'm about to talk about. I'm a CrossFitter, and I'm actually about to open my own CrossFit gym. Our sole eating regimen that we do is something called a paleo diet. Its focus is...
Jarrett, we're losing you. Okay. Gosh, I'm sorry we lost him. Maybe he'll call back when he's in a better place.
We can probably run with a paleo diet.
I have no idea what that is. Gary Taubes, a paleo diet?
Well, the subtext in all these diets, as David already suggested, is that we more or less eat what we evolved to eat and avoid those foods that are sort of unique to the Industrial Revolution. And so when David talks about, and correct me if I'm wrong, when you talk about eating holistically, we can argue, you know, we're eating whole foods, we're eating foods as they come out of the ground. And the paleo, we're talking about the period of human evolution, the Paleolithic era that stretched from, you know, 2 million years ago to 10,000 years ago. The way I heard it described recently was if human evolution was a football field, the agricultural era would be the last 7 inches of the field, and the Industrial Revolution would be the last, you know, centimeter or so. And so we want to eat as we did previously. And so that's mostly animal products and tubers. And so you avoid grains, you avoid sugars, fruit in moderation, and mostly berries, the kind of fruits that would have been gathered by hunters and gatherers over the course of history. And you could think of it as a carbohydrate-restricted diet that's very low in sugar, added sugars, but it also happens to be low in grains and starches. And one of the issues when we're discussing this is even, it's funny when I'm listening to David and we're supposed to talk tomorrow, how we really agree on virtually most things, but he has a more clinical view on some issues, I'm not sure all, and I take a more scientific perspective where I do believe that in order to make progress finally and to get rid of to clear up the last century of confusion and obfuscation, it's almost imperative that we talk in terms of single nutrients because that's how science works.
Gary, could I ask you a question? So regarding our caller, and you described the paleo diet, you know, what you would get if you were still a hunter-gatherer, basically, is that a good way to go?
I think so, Dr. Katz.
Yeah, thanks. I'd like to jump in if I may, Laura.
Sure.
A couple of additions to the paleo diet. First, it wasn't a mostly animal food diet. I've corresponded extensively with some of the leading paleoanthropologists in the world, Boyd Eaton among them, and the consensus is about 50% of our calories came from animal foods and 50% from plant foods. And since plant foods tend to be energy dilute, they have fewer calories per volume, actually the bulk of the diet was plant foods, which came from gathering half the calories from animal foods. The animal foods were radically different from animal foods we eat today, and much like the flesh of antelope, which has only about 7% of the calories from fat, and it's almost all unsaturated fat. And it's even a pretty good source of omega-3, which we now think of as fish oil.
What also, about sugar, Dr. Katz? And I'm sorry to interrupt you, but since we're talking about sugar, where does this paleo diet come down on sugar? It doesn't sound like there's any sugar in it at all, practically.
Well, there were plant foods which included fruits, berries in particular, fruits that could be gathered. They obviously weren't cultivated. So that there certainly was fructose in that diet. There was honey in that diet. It was a treat. And you know, it probably is about the level of sugar intake that's optimal for us. The other thing is there was an enormous intake of fiber. The estimate is 100 grams a day. And if you're eating 100 grams of fiber, you probably can tolerate even more sugar than some people eat these days. And enormous physical activity. So a very different lifestyle.
Well,
I do think it's a healthy way of eating, but it's very, very hard to approximate, and we can probably sum that up by asking when's the last time you've seen a mammoth. So, you know, people often do a very poor, they claim they're eating paleo, but they don't even really get very close.
Well, here's a question related to something you just said, Dr. Katz, and Gary, I'll throw it to you. This is an email, let's see, this person, Christopher, an email from Christopher who says, isn't a big part of the obesity problem lack of exercise? Is sugar processed differently when paired with adequate exercise? Again, this is from Christopher in Manchester. What do you think, Gary Taubes?
Well, the answer is sugar is certainly processed differently when paired with exercise, but the world is full of extraordinarily hardworking people who manage to get obese anyway. And one of the arguments I have against this idea of thinking of obesity merely as this energy issue, we take in more calories than we expend, is if I were to show Dr. Katz an obese construction worker who's running up and down ladders all day long with 60 pounds of tools on his belt, and I would argue, well, look, this shows you that physical activity isn't an issue because here's a guy working harder than we do, far harder, burning far more calories, and yet he's still fat. And the counterargument would be then obviously he eats too much. And so the argument would be, yeah, it is indeed processed differently, but you will change how you process it over time. So your body is quite that, you know, we all have this experience that we can eat anything. Well, we used to all have this experience. Now that with the obesity epidemic, it may not be true anymore. When I was a child, it was clear that we could all eat anything when you're in your 20s, including several sodas a day while you're doing your schoolwork to get the caffeine to crunch for exams at schools like Yale. The question is, how does that change with time, and how does that mitigate moot even the effects of exercise? So I don't believe that exercise is caused by being sedentary. Again, I think that obesity is caused by being sedentary. I think the evidence argues pretty strongly that obesity, like I said, is a hormonal defect triggered by our environment. And then the question is, what is that trigger? Is it the sugars, the added sugars and sodas, which a lot of evidence can support? Is it also the refined grains that we eat, these high glycemic index carbohydrates? And a lot of evidence supports that as well. If you were to eat a paleo diet, then I would take issue with how Dr. Katz described the paleo diet.
And Gary, I'm so sorry I got to cut you off. Yeah, we have to go to a short break, but we will be right back. And we'll take more of your calls, too, at 1-800-892-6477.
Today on Word of Mouth, God Save the Queen. She's good for democracy. We'll explore the mystique of the modern monarchy and why it's essential to Britain's populist politics. And Maximizing Your Mini Farm, a locavore's guide for backyard gardeners. I'm Virginia Prescott. Word of Mouth waters the seeds of new ideas. Today at noon and again at 9 on NHPR.
This is NHPR, where support comes from UR members and from Merrimack County Savings Bank, helping the community thrive for over 144 years with 7 full-service branches in Bow, Kentucky, Concord, and Nashua. TheMerrimack.com. And New Hampshire Moose Plates, where 100% of license plate fees go to programs that support the state's natural, historical, and cultural heritage. MoosePlate.com. Good morning. It's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, the prospects for the latest education funding amendment in the New Hampshire legislature. Email us your questions and comments before the program at exchange@nhpr.org. and join us tomorrow morning live at 9. Today in the Exchange, shunning sugar, new research on sugar and its effects on our bodies, and the question of whether this delicious substance should be regulated. Join us with your questions and comments, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Emails are welcome. Keep them short. The address is exchange@nhpr.org, or go to our Facebook page. And Dr. David Katz and Gary Taubes, lots more emails and calls that I want to share with you. And here's an email from Morgan, who says, could the plastics, pesticides, and other chemicals in all foods, including sugars, be the real root of the problem rather than that these, quote, bad, than these, quote, bad foods themselves? Morgan says moderation is important, but this moderation may be less helpful when most of our food is treated, processed, and added to with harmful chemicals. Morgan, good question. And David Katz, do you want to take that one?
Sure, thank you. Well, if what we're asking about in terms of harms, Morgan, is the obesity and the chronic diseases that relate to it, my standard answer to this is once we have accounted for that portion of the obesity epidemic that is fully explained away by eating too much of all the wrong things and doing too little, whatever's left I'd be happy to explain by invoking contaminants in food and various esoteric theories like exposure to adenovirus S36 and the microbiota of our intestinal tract and so forth. So, yeah, you know, I think there are all sorts of contaminants in the modern food supply. It's a shame. There are chemicals. There are things we've done to the planet that are irrevocable, and they affect our food. But we eat too much, we do too little, and it does create energy imbalance. And I disagree here with Gary. We have evidence that when you overfeed people protein, they gain weight, they get fat, and they're prone to insulin resistance because it's the obesity itself that can drive that. And we have evidence that when people are physically active, it improves their health whether or not it protects against weight gain. And the reason it doesn't protect against weight gain is because it is so much easier to out-eat your exercise than to out-exercise food. You know, you think about a soda, for example, that you can down without thinking about it literally in seconds. And if that's a couple of hundred calories, and it easily can be that much or more, that's brisk walking for an hour. You know, so we just, it doesn't matter. With the concentration of food energy available in modern society, you just can't outrun that for the most part, unless you're truly an elite athlete. So I think it really is an excess of calories from various sources, sugar being an important one of them, and a lack of physical activity that most conspire against our health. And we have good evidence. We have evidence that if you avoid tobacco, eat well, and are physically active, and eating well doesn't mean avoiding all these toxins, Morgan, because they're out there and they're hard to avoid. It means eating vegetables, fruits, whole grains, nuts, seeds, beans, lentils, that the risk of obesity and all major chronic diseases can be slashed 80%. And we have no such evidence for avoiding just one particular food contaminant or for avoiding just sugar. We have that evidence for the whole dietary pattern.
You know, you mentioned, Dr. Katz, soda, and certainly we've talked about that, how it kind of gives your body an instant whoosh in terms of sugar. What do the two of you think? I'm curious, Gary Taubes, you first, about Mayor Bloomberg's proposal to ban large sodas in certain places like sports arenas or movie theaters.
Well, it's interesting. If you watch the recent HBO documentary on obesity, The Weight of the Nation, there's a scene in which Thomas Farley, the New York City Health Commissioner, walks into a bodega, and there's a whole wall of six 2-liter soda bottles, and Dr. Farley points at this display and says, "There's the obesity epidemic right there." And I wonder if Mayor Bloomberg was merely watching the HBO special and thought to himself, "Well, if that's the obesity epidemic, let's get rid of it."
Isn't that overly simplistic, though?
Level,
what do you think, Gary? Yeah, I'm sorry to interrupt you.
I mean,
what do you think?
I have trouble with the government. I would like the scientific community to understand these arguments better, to understand the nuances of human biology better. I would like when you go into a doctor's office like Dr. Katz, if what I've been arguing is correct, it would be nice if people, you know, back in the 1960s, the idea used to be that certain foods were uniquely fattening, and there were all these sort of carbohydrate-rich foods and sweets and drinks, and so instead of getting the advice to eat less and exercise more, you would get the advice to avoid these foods that are uniquely fattening, just like if a smoker walks into the doctor's office, they get the advice to quit smoking. Whether you need to go as far as making these foods unavailable, or weirdly enough, in this case, I find myself agreeing with Mayor Bloomberg. I can't imagine how this would hurt, and I could imagine how it would help.
So can't hurt, might help.
Can't hurt, might help, exactly. Dr. Katz would point out, and as I document in my books, back in the 1970s when we first went after dietary fat, they used the exact same argument, can't hurt, might help. And since then, we've had an obesity epidemic and a diabetes epidemic, so maybe it did hurt.
All right. Our phone number again here on The Exchange is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email us, exchange@nhpr.org. And, gentlemen, let's go next to Sean in Franklin. Go ahead, Sean. You're on the air.
Hi. Good morning.
Morning.
Just wondering if someone could comment on how sugar, especially excess sugar, affects your immune system. I've been reading a lot of information lately how that is fairly detrimental to your immune system, basically in your gut.
Okay. Sean, thanks a lot for the question. Dr. Katz, sugar in your immune system.
Sure. And again, just but lest we go down the wrong path here, hormonal balances that are associated with eating lots of added sugar or lots of starch or overconsumption of calories and the accumulation of body fat tend all to be pro-inflammatory. So I don't think we can just pin this on sugar, but you know, essentially you look at the epidemic of obesity and all the things fueling it, we have a lot of insulin resistance. So about half of the people who are overweight in the United States, that's a huge number of people. And by the way, I disagree that obesity is not about energy imbalance. Fundamentally, I think that's exactly what it's about. And hormonal imbalances result from an excess of calories in, a deficiency of calories out. But about half the overweight population is insulin resistant to one degree or another, and so you know, arguably that's 100 million people. When you have high levels of insulin, that triggers the release of other hormones that oppose the action of insulin, and those include the fight-or-flight hormones and cortisol. And when all of these hormonal levels rise, they do exert powerful effects on the immune system, which do two things. One, they tend to cultivate dysfunctional inflammation. And so, you know, essentially the kind of inflammation that injures blood vessels and nerve cells and bad stuff. And because the immune system is tied up in inflammation that's not constructive, it's less available, really, to help fight infections and rogue cells that can lead to cancer. And so, yes, absolutely. Excess sugar, excess calories, obesity, insulin resistance, excess starch, junky food all contribute to immune system dysfunction.
Well, and Dr. Katz, I had an email here also from Marion Pelham who asks about the inflammatory effect of sugar on the body, and you said yes. And Dr. Katz, is that the link with cancer? I mean, we've all heard about sugar causing, you know, aiding and abetting obesity and diabetes, but the cancer link seems newer to me. Is that what that link is about, inflammation?
Probably so. Probably mediated via impairment of immune system function, inflammation. And, you know, inflammation is not a bad thing, really. We have to think in terms of yin and yang and balance. You know, essentially, inflammation is the body's defense against germs. But when you have inflammation you don't need, then you have collateral damage. It's damaging the healthy cells. But actually, Laura, there's a very important point to make with regard to cancer. So, yes, sugar is potentially a contributor to cancer risk, but studies done in particular at Harvard in huge cohorts of over 100,000 people actually highlight processed meat as one of the major risk factors for cancer and meat intake in general as an important risk factor for cancer, which brings me back to the argument I'm most passionate about. We cannot focus on just one nutrient. It's the whole pattern of the diet. So if we say, okay, well, sugar's the only thing we need to worry about, I can eat all the pastrami I want, I actually think cancer risk will go up and cancer rates could go up. It's only by getting the whole thing right, looking at overall nutritional quality, the quality of the whole dietary pattern, that we're going to get to the prize. And the prize is vitality, more years in life, more life in years. The just focus on sugar argument will not take us there.
Well, and here's an email from Kevin who says, and I think I'll give this to you first, Gary Taubes. Kevin says, I hiked the Appalachian Trail in 2000 and would eat a ton of calories on every resupply. ice cream and soda for breakfast, chicken fried steak for lunch, all you can eat, anything for dinner. During the course of the hike, I went from 245 pounds to 185 pounds. Kevin says this seems to support that if you use up more calories than you take in, you will lose weight no matter what you eat. Great email, Kevin. Thank you so much, and congratulations for hiking the Appalachian Trail many years ago. What do you think, Gary Taubes?
Well, there's absolutely no doubt that you could starve people, or as The Biggest Loser shows, you can make them work out 6 hours a day, like the equivalent of hiking the Appalachian Trail, and people will lose weight. That's undeniable. But by the same token, you can, you know, when children are starved, it stunts their growth, but that does not mean that the growth is caused by somehow the excess of calories. And again, that's the same argument we're making here, is that you can starve an obese person and you could starve a lean person, or you could force them to do exercise while you restrict their calories. Obviously, if our hiker had, you know, could not keep up with the calories he was expending for this period of time. But that does not mean that the growth of the fat mass was just caused by this, you know, the calories somehow slipping into the fat because we consume too many of them. To me, it's a viewpoint that's almost, you know, biologically is almost naive beyond comprehension. And I just wanted to speak briefly to these studies that show that meat consumption is apparently could cause cancer. What these studies show, and Dr. Katz should be more precise in his terminology, they're what are known as observational studies. So we follow large groups of people for 20, 30 years. We find that for the ones who tend to be vegetarians tend to have less disease, so that the vegetarian lifestyle is associated with less cancer. But the problem is that the people who choose to be vegetarians, this is an observation and tells you nothing about cause and effect. The people who choose to be vegetarians, we know from the data, are better educated, they're more health conscious, they have better doctors, they smoke less, they weigh less, they exercise more. There's a whole host of healthful behaviors.
It's not just the diet.
We have no idea
what aspect is the diet. And part of the problem, part of what I've been trying to clear up in my writing, is this sort of use of poor, what I would just call bad science. So you have an observation, two factors are associated, like as my mother used to say, the price of tea in China and my behavior that day. And then you have to ask the question, is that association meaningful? Is there a causal factor?
Okay.
And
in these studies that
come out of Harvard, there's no causality that can be identified, and the Harvard people in particular have been lax in doing the kind of necessary analysis, as I pointed out in a cover story in the New York Times Magazine in 2007.
Okay, Gary, I'm sorry. I got to let we've limited time, so I do need to let Dr. Katz jump in. And then I'd like to ask you one final question about sugar, because that's really our focus
today. That is the topic. So just quickly, I run a research lab, and Gary does not. I spent yesterday morning, in fact, at a conference with Walter Willett, the principal investigator of these large cohort studies at Harvard. We know about research methodology. I've written a textbook on it. And with very careful control in multivariable analysis, you look at all the things Gary just mentioned. You adjust for physical activity, for smoking, for other habits. Observational studies are not perfect by any means, but they're the best you can do because we can't randomly assign people to different diets for decades. Nobody's willing to sign up for those trials. So we're always going to be left to draw conclusions from imperfect science. The evidence, though, accumulates over time, and it's overwhelmingly clear that aspects of the diet other than sugar, like meat intake, like processed meat intake, exert potentially very important effects on health. We should not ignore that. And frankly, having read a fair amount of Gary's writing, if he likes the result of a particular study, the science is good, and if he dislikes it, it's bad. We have to be far more balanced in our judgments about that. Observational studies are limited, but they're not useless.
Can we ask just one last question about sugar? And Gary, to you, what about this idea that keeps coming up this hour, that it's too simple to just target sugar, that we need to look at our lifestyles overall, that just blaming one particular food is too simple a solution? We need to look at exercise. We need to look at, you know, processed meats and so forth. What do you think, Gary?
Well, and that's the point Dr. Katz is making, and it could be true. But the counterargument would be when we talk about lung cancer, we target cigarettes. When we talk about cirrhosis of the liver, we target alcohol. And the question we're asking here is that degree of causality present? And, you know, despite everything Dr. Katz has been arguing, there is evidence that it is. And one of, and then, you know, do we want, and there's a difference, do we want a blanket public health recommendation to eat no sugar? Well, obviously, the evidence doesn't support that yet, but it might.
Would people follow it, though?
And the question is, what can we do to get the government, in part, the National Institutes of Health, the funding agents, to invest in studying this further? It's you know, we're talking about massive health problems here. Obesity and type 2 diabetes are, you know, going to overwhelm the healthcare system, as well as the horrible burden they place on the people who have them. And to insist that these people should merely exercise more and eat less, as though, you know, fundamental human physiology and biology are irrelevant, is kind of an odd stance to take, even if, you know, this is the kind of thing that nutritionists have been pushing for 50 years. It obviously hasn't worked yet.
And why hasn't it worked? Because we can't do the moderation thing, Gary?
That's the argument, that the food supply just makes too much food available, and so obese people can't say no. I guess lean people can, obese people can't. I think that the problem is far more profound, and I've simply been arguing that the evidence supports that.
Well, so much to talk about, and I'm sorry we have to wrap it up here. And Gary Taubes, thank you again very much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Gary Taubes, his most recent book is Why We Get Fat and What to Do About It, contributing correspondent to the Journal Science and a Robert Wood Johnson Foundation independent investigator in health policy research at the University of California at Berkeley. Dr. David Katz, thank you also. It was very good to talk to you.
Likewise, Laura. Thank you.
Dr. David Katz, founding director of Yale University's Prevention Research Center, editor-in-chief of the journal Childhood Obesity, and president-elect of the American College of Lifestyle Medicine. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our intern is Ryan Lassard. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange is now on Facebook. Become a fan of our Facebook page. We can